Welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming to this conference. I want to welcome you again on behalf of Church of All Nations. Introduce myself for those who maybe were not here last night. My name is Jim Bear Jacobs. I'm a pastor on staff here at Church of All Nations. I have been here for about 3 years. And I also founded a group in the fall of 2011 called Healing Minnesota Stories. The purpose of Healing Minnesota Stories is to bring the Native voice and Indigenous story into areas, circles where it has not been welcomed or overlooked for generations now. We are an initiative of the St. Paul Interfaith Network. So because of that relationship, much of our contact and our engagement is in faith communities, interfaith, and interreligious work. So as part of that work, we are often in churches, civic groups, schools, Rotary Club meetings, you know, these kind of things. And really, people often mistake what I do because they hear that I'm a minister and I'm a native. So there's an assumption that my work is bringing the theological message down into Native circles, and our work is really quite the opposite. It is bringing the Native voice and perspective into the world of theology, churches, ecclesiology, things like that. So please understand that's the work we do. Oftentimes, especially some of my old conservative evangelical friends, they'll say, well, is your work, you're doing this ministry. You know, they don't even know if to call it a ministry. We don't necessarily call it that, but I think it is indeed. But they'll say, well, is it evangelistic in any sense? And I said, absolutely, but not in the sense that you think it is. It is moving up rather than disseminating down. And if you were on the Sacred Sites tour yesterday, or have been on a tour with us in the past, I suppose I should introduce that. We, as part of our work, one of the things that we have done and have done so for a number of years now that really gets a lot of interest and attraction is throughout the spring, summer, and fall, we will invite people to come out on a 3 to 4 hour Sacred Sites tour in which we explore a couple of the sites that are intimately tied into Dakota creation narratives and also the intersections of Minnesota history and Dakota people relations and that. And the reason we do these tours is not simply so that we can academically transfer knowledge from one mind to another, but in our tours, for as long as we've been doing this, everyone, and to this point now it's over 3,000 people in the last 4 years, everyone has been given tobacco and told, this is your time now. Go out into the space. You've heard the story. You've heard us tell this story. But go out into the space and listen to it for yourself. And they go out into the space and they have their tobacco. And what we want to, when we were asked if we would do this workshop, we thought that it would be perhaps just interesting, and maybe it's not interesting, this is an experiment, But perhaps it would be interesting if we just recall some of the things we notice as we stand in a circle and we watch spirits awaken to the stories around them. And often people, for the first time in their lives, understanding that story is present around them. And one of the things we discuss when we do this tour is how we, as traditionally educated Western people, are conditioned to treat story. And what I mean by that, and if you were with us yesterday, this is just review. We are conditioned to understand story as it exists in time. And so we have the arrow of time. History plays out on a linear scale, a linear timeline. And we are conditioned to believe that story exists in time. And so this is very convenient for a Western mindset, especially a Euro-Western mindset, a Euro-American Western mindset, because it allows us to create great distance between us and the stories. And so when we think of the history in this area, in the U.S.-Dakota War, and the hangings at Mankato, the bounties on Dakota people's heads, all of that happens, you know, in this brief timeline. You know, the stealing, the really shady treaty negotiations, all of that happens from about 1851 and really concludes in about 1865. Okay, so we have that brief time period, some 150, 160 years ago, and we here in the 21st century, we don't have to feel that story, because we're 160 years, there's that much distance separating us. This is quite different than an indigenous understanding of story, because story does not exist in time, but story actually exists in space. And so when we bring people down into the site of one of history's first concentration camps, we are intentionally bringing people into a story. They're present in the story. And maybe, yes, it was 152, 3 years ago now. But the space is still there, and the story is still there. And we give people tobacco, and we prime them. We let them know that this story still exists. And when the space speaks to them, incredible things happen. I remember the first time, this happened. This was very early on when I started doing these tours, and Bob had not yet, I had not yet met Bob, and he had not yet joined me in doing these tours. But I gave everyone tobacco, and I sent them out into the space, and I told them to listen. And I remember the first time someone came back and told me they heard something. And I thought, what just happened? Because, like, I know the space speaks to you. I know the space contains story. I know that that story is present there. But I didn't know it. I didn't expect that it would really happen. Right? And then this first young man comes out of the woods and he says, I gotta tell you what I heard down there. And it was incredible. And I won't relay that. That is his story, and I haven't asked him permission to share that. But I will tell you now that It's not every tour where we hear something like that, but it's often enough it doesn't surprise us at all when people will say, this is what I heard down there. This is what I saw on top of the hill. I remember one of my favorite ones was we had a group of college students out. And there was a young man on the tour who I knew his dad to be a rather conservative pastor in rural Minnesota. And he was on the tour and again told the story of the space. We were down in the concentration campsite, told the story of the space, gave everyone tobacco, told them go out, be present, say a prayer, listen, be here. Listen with your heart, with your spirit, not your ears. And he, like the rest of the 25 students, goes out. He's one of the first ones to come back. And he's visibly shaken. He's near tears. And he comes up to me. And remember, this is the pastor's kid of a very conservative pastor. And in a denomination that is not known for its acceptance of movements of spirit and things like that. And he says to me, he looks me right in the eye, and he says, I don't have visions. And I'm like, great, okay. And he says, you don't understand. I don't have visions. But this is what I just saw. And I'm watching as his theological framework is completely imploding because he does not have the capacity to contain this. He hasn't been taught that story is alive in space and not dead in time. And he couldn't contain, he had no way. And literally, he tells me his vision. He had this beautiful, elaborate vision of trees that water was dripping off of their leaves, and as it was dripping off of their leaves, he knew them to be tears. The trees were weeping, and before they dropped to the ground, they took on the tinge of blood red and went back into the ground. It's just beautiful, beautiful vision. And he tells me all these things, and he walks away, still muttering, I heard him. I don't have visions. But for the first time, this young man, and what happens now? He goes back into a world where maybe it doesn't allow for the aliveness of story. Will he have visions again? I don't know. But he knows now that it's possible that story is alive. And want to allow some time for my good friend, my mentor here. He and I have been doing a lot of this work together for about 4 years now. Together, so.
Wow. Oh. Wow. It's hard to follow that. Not that I need to follow anything. My name is Bob Glanderud. My Indian name is Akija Okawijacha. Given to me by the Prairie Island family, the Owen family. It means the man who makes a sound for the people. So the translation of my name would be a loud sound, kind of like an eagle scream. And I must carry that name and understand it in my life. And so for a lot of years, I'm over 60 now, but for a lot of years, I've had to get up and let it rip out. And they said, you must crack the sky like lightning with your voice for the people. And then the women would usually do a lili, and the men would do this akija when we had an honoring or anything. So, my name is a sound by my voice. And I love listening to my brother Jim Bear. Not only is he a formally educated man, but by virtue of his DNA and the native blood he has, he's able to expound these things from the native world in a way that a lot of people can understand easily. So our voices are sacred, and that's what we're sharing here today, is this communication and this transmission of understandings and knowledge via our voice. And that what Jim Bear explained with the tours is what a lot of people are looking for as a new way of learning and understanding. And so I'm not formally educated. I went to, I think I went to 10th grade. I had a lot of brothers and sisters to take care of in an alcoholic home, and a mother to patch up a lot. So as the oldest male, I just did that and went to work. And my teaching has come from the friends, family, and relatives I've met that have shared their knowledge and understandings. And from 38 years of living one day at a time, and I say that because I'm a recovering alcoholic and drug addict, and I lived the first half of my life pickled and numb because of, I can see it now, is a lot of historic trauma that's been trapped in my DNA. And I think a lot of Native men and women share that same thing, that we must overcome this grave emotional obstacle in our lives enough to stand up and to be able to expound some of the understandings we have. So this is called oral tradition. And it's one of the things that we were judged and sentenced to as savages and barbarians because the European world didn't see us making the black marks on paper. So therefore, we must be ignorant and unable to educate from that level of academia. But what we understand as Native people is the purposefulness for oral tradition, in that not only are you able to understand with your ears, these ears, what Jim Bear is saying, but as a Native man, the voice of his heart speaks between these audible English words that he's speaking to you in the language of his heart, in the language of his people, from the core of his being, in that he is a chalice of all his ancestors sitting before us, as well as I, as well as everybody here. So what I need to explain is the purposefulness of oral tradition and the spoken narrative of the information we're transmitting to you. So not only are your ears and the gray matter between your ears collecting and assimilating the knowledge that we're telling you, as Native people, we use oral tradition for the reasons that I've just explained, because we're more than just what you see. And we are multidimensional beings existing in this moment of time. And we're creating history by these narratives we're explaining to you. But I need to let you know that as Native people, and if people are looking for a way of understanding how do the trees drip that water, how do we have visions, and that we live from a different place. We don't place a lot of value on IQ quotient or the size of your cerebral cortex or your cranium. We place a lot of precedence on what we call the Hocho Ka. It's a sacred center of your existence and your being, which is your heart. Because when your heart stops pumping, you will be in the spirit world and you will no longer be a two-legged. So that's what makes us sacred, is that sacred blood that flows and pumps through our veins via our heart. And that's the temple where our spirit resides. And I'm not a a theologian, and I really don't know a lot about Christianity. But in saying I've lived 38 years, a day at a time, by the grace of God, it was because at that time in my life when I couldn't stop drinking because my body had to have it, and I was strung out on cocaine and using an ounce of cocaine a week up my nose, and that was in the 70s, the early 70s, I didn't want to live because I was so full of rage and anger at the injustices I'd seen, the way I'd seen as a baby and a boy, the way I'd seen my beautiful native mother treated by the dominant white society we lived in, terribly, by well-meaning, sometimes Christian people, academic people, treating my mother like a savage and a barbarian. It made me angry. And I carried that anger in the way the history books, when we were sitting in school, they said, you know, these terrible Indians, they massacred all these white settlements. And so the narrative that I learned from the history books made me ashamed of being Indian, coupled with the abject poverty and the alcoholism and abuse that I lived in. I didn't have a lot of hope in people or faith in people. Until that time, I put a gun in my mouth because I didn't want to die, but I didn't know how to live. I didn't believe in the rhetoric and the lies I was being told. So I was going to try and check out. And at 1976, I was given a chinupa to carry. I didn't know how to carry it because I'd never seen an eagle feather or any ceremonies or beautiful aspects of being Native American.
Just tell them that the chinupa is the pipe.
The chinupa is a sacred pipe that we shared this morning. And I'm just a pipe carrier. I carry that sacred pipe for the people. It's not mine. I don't own it. I try to walk and live my life in such a way that I can carry that chinupa for the people when it's needed. So to try and bring it down to a little closer close here to what I'm saying, that I feel motivated by that spirit to say to you folks today that you may well know, but I'll remind you that we live from our Ho-Chunka as Native people. Through this oral tradition, you must open the eyes and ears of your heart to understand this knowledge we're transmitting to you, because it defies a lot of linear cerebral understanding. And so, in order to understand the sacredness of water, you can think from a scientific, empirical point of view, or you can go to your heart and say, how does that make you feel? You know, we need water to live. It's the first medicine the Creator gave us. All matter on this planet, Mother Earth, is comprised of H2O. And to me, water is like Jesus Christ for me. It saves me every day. It washes my mind, body, spirit, heart, and soul, and makes me whole. We defile it, we pollute it, and we abuse it. It goes into Mother Earth and it comes back pure again. It can rise above the laws of the universe and God that keep us subject to Earth, gravity, in trillions of tons. And so for a man to see the water dripping out of the tree, and that's that tree's offering, it comes to me in the same way. I lived on Bear Butte for a couple years, and I would go clean up the camp, and I'd lay in the grass, and one of my first experiences was laying in the grass in the morning, praying, and the grass bending over me, and the little drops that came to the end. And suddenly I noticed every blade of grass worked all night to get this offering of a drop of water in the morning dew. And when the sun came up and grandfather came up, they would offer that dew drop. And so each blade of grass, and I watched the water rise up in a fog, mist, and become a cloud and stand there in the sky. And then that cloud needed the assistance of the four winds, the Tate Dopa Oyate. So we look at the wind as being alive. It's just not a dead, inanimate force. And it doesn't necessarily blow. Maybe it's drawn to or suck. You know, so our simple ceremony is that the sacredness of life is that we all need water, and that everything offers that prayer, and that becomes a cloud with the assistance of the wind. That cloud will go over there where the grass and trees are crying for water from the Creator and bring that life back to the earth. So that simple cycle and that symbiotic relationship we live with, that water is the most sacred substance we use on this earth, next to our blood, which is, we are 98% water. So we have a real symbiotic relationship to water, which is the first medicine from Dakota Lakota way. We call it Minewachoni, which means the sacred water of life. So speaking to you from my sacred Hochoka, my center, and my voice and my spirit that moves me to work with this man, I see the sacredness in him and what he has to offer in just a humble, simple way, as fallible human beings, as sinners, as people on the same plane of existence, how water plays such an important role. And in fact, this Mother Earth doesn't need us. We need her more than she needs us. We are one of the inhabitants of this planet. The trees have spirit. They talk with each other. And they're connected via their root systems. And they talk to each other around the world. The four-legged communicate via a spirit of their guiding spirit. The winged ones can do that as well. So it's up for us to learn a new way of understanding, like Chad and Elaine and Pastor Jen said this morning, to be reborn means to take on a new understanding of how we view and see the world. And so my Christian understanding that saved my life when I put the shotgun in my mouth 38 years ago, that I hunted every day with to get food for my family, and I pulled the trigger and the shell didn't go off, I threw it down and I realized that there's something more I need to do. So I got on my knees and I prayed for whatever good was out there. I didn't believe in Christ or anything. And that light came through the window and hit me in the head and knocked me down. And I was paralyzed. And I didn't know if I was dying or dead. And that light told me in the English ways I could understand that was Christ. And so then I saw a picture in my mind, of a childhood picture of this man knocking on a door with a lantern. And he said, "Behold, I knock. Who can let me in? Who can hear me?" And I thought, well, if that's the Son of God, why doesn't he just open the door and go in? But then I realized this sacred place has no doorknob on the outside. And I saw that door in the picture in my mind, and I thought, oh, it doesn't have a doorknob. Then I realized you must open that door and invite that spirit in. Even Jesus Christ can't get in here, because we have free will as humans. We can do what we want. There are rewards and consequences for our actions. So I let that slide in. And it said, "I am Christ. I'm going to bring your spirit back to you that left you when you were a little boy, when I started using popping gas and sniffing glue at 5, 6, 7 years old, stealing codeine cough syrup from the drugstore just to get numb because of my Indianness and the way I felt about that." And so that light said, let go. We're in this river of life. And so I let go. And it took me up and out to a place where they brought my spirit back to me. So since then, I haven't had to have a drink or sniff of cocaine. And so that's why I say I was saved by the Holy Spirit of Christ. And I consider myself a Christian, because I know what grace is, and I was riding motorcycles and being a bad man, robbing people for drugs, and I just thought, how could you save a wretch like me when there's so many other good people around. And so I felt it's my responsibility with knowing that then to walk in a better way and learn how to be a better person for these reasons. And I believe that the Creator has kept the red people silent till this time now. When we're standing in that medicine wheel like we saw up on Knob Hill, red, yellow, black, and white together in this circle, in this hoop of life, together we live. And we're coming back in here, this hoop is mending, that we stand together in this way because we need each other and we need these understandings. And now humanity has become so displaced and disconnected from the natural order of life that they need the teachings of the native world to remind them and teach them how to reconnect with these things of other life forms on this living planet, Mother Earth. So my part in this is to be able to take people from their linear thinking and hook them into that Ho-Chunka. Open that door for them if they don't know how, and teach them where the doorknob is, where the light switches are, and to learn how to open and close the door. But you must invite that spirit in. So to understand water more, maybe you could look from that place and invite that spirit into you. And as Native people, when we have such a symbiotic relationship with the earth and life, the wind and the air, I'm never alone. In 38 years, I've never been alone. Because my mother, who is in the ground now, I find in this earth. My father, who is dead, I find in the sunrise. And I feel connected to the wind in more of a personal way, like it's a relative. And I pray to the wind. I say, thank you for a gentle breeze that wicks the sweat off my face when I'm working. Thank you for that wind in my sails that gives me motivation and direction in this course of life. And thank you, stars, for a zenith and azimuth to set my bearings by. And for navigation, that's my relatives up there. So I feel close to them. I feel a part of this Mother Earth because I am of this Mother Earth. I honor women because I came from a woman, and I'll go back to a woman. They're stronger than us as men. They give life. And we need to honor that in a sacred way. So in talking about water with y'all and sharing some Native ideologies, and to be born and to be reborn into spirit, maybe some of those things can help you in your journey and walk and trying to connect. It's like trying to sit down and learn the language of birds. Are you Indians? You can hear the, what's the song of the wind? What's that bird say? Well, 30 years sun dancing every year, I go to that tree of life together with my brothers and sisters from around the world. We come together at that time of the year, and we meld our hearts. We stand there, we have no food or water for days, and we dance sun up to sundown in rejoicing of life in the spirit of the Holy Spirit that can come through that tree. But we get connected, and it takes 4 days of giving up that which sustains life to know the sacredness of water, to know the sustenance of food we take and the bread we take, to know each other is fallible and we're doing the best we can to stand here. We're doing the best we can to be open vessels and hollow bones for that Holy Spirit to work through. So I don't have anything planned to say, and I let that spirit work through me. Just every time we come together, it always does. It always puts into our minds, our mouths, and our words that which needs to be said for whoever's listening, for whatever reason. But we feel connected. And so when you're connected in that way to the heart of a bird, you feel that bird. It's like a Zen way of mindfulness, of really thinking about that water and smelling it and feeling a refreshment that it takes to bring into that life and to really assimilate it in a different way. So I'm honored to be here. a little piece that I had to say, and Jim Bear can take it from there.
He always says that he has no formal theological education, and then he just goes and does that. This is why I'm committed to do the work I'm doing, because this man would not be invited in any Bible college or seminary, because he doesn't have an education across past the 10th grade. And this is the voice that's needed in seminaries and our Bible colleges. And it's very difficult getting those in the academy to understand that they need this voice, these voices. One more thing I want to say, and then this always works better if we are just conversational, and we're in a circle, so it's conducive to conversation anyway. Oftentimes in our linear Western mindset, we don't understand how to approach story. We don't understand how to listen to story, but your spirit understands. And I've seen faces being affected just in the words that Bob is saying, and all he's doing is he's speaking the story. And you could read that story on paper, but it wouldn't affect you in the same way, because as he mentioned, your spirit speaks between the words, and that's what you're feeling, and that's your emotional reaction to that spirit that comes out between the words. And when we understand story is alive in space, it can be beautiful, because we can enter into space where indigenous people still hold on to the spaces of their creation narrative, and can touch the clay that is used to create the first Dakota people, or the first Navajo people, or Ojibwe people, or Mohican people. They have rootedness in space. We may be distant. My people are, 1,100 to 1,200 miles away from where we were created, but it still exists. Our story is still present. Dakota people are often thousands of miles away from Bedote, the convergence of these rivers, but the story is still present there. And so we can enter into that river valley or that sacred mountain or wherever it is, and we can be fully present in the celebration of life and creation in that space. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful when that happens. It's beautiful when you hear the whispers and the songs of creation in those sacred spaces. But also, because story is alive in space and not dead in time, it can be very difficult. And I want to relay one story for you, a very personal story. My grandmother is 93 years old. She is just over the height requirement to not need a booster seat when she rides in a car. Mm-hmm. She's 93 years old, and she's about 4'8". Tiny woman, completely filled with fire. And some will understand. She is an Indian grandmother. Our reservation in central Wisconsin is 22,000 acres. It's very small. And my grandmother has spent almost all of her 93 years within the borders of these 22,000 acres. One of my favorite things to do is when I go visit my grandmother, I put her in the front seat of my car, I buckle her in, and we leave her driveway, and we drive. And as soon as we turn out of her driveway, her mouth opens, and story upon story floods out of her mouth. It's beautiful. It's such an intimate moment. And she has, as I said, it's 22,000 acres. She has a story for every square foot of that reservation. She spent 93 years there. And so we go around this turn, and she says, that river right there, that bend in that river, that is where your great uncle Joseph chopped a hole in the ice so he could be baptized in February.
Whoa.
This here, this is the road where my great aunt, who was deaf and serving as a cook in a logging camp, smuggled me out of the logging camp on her back for 6 miles at night because she didn't think a logging camp was a safe place for a young girl. Story after story after story. And there is a cemetery. And one day, this was 3 years ago. So Grandma's 91 at this time. And I said, Grandma, let's go visit Grandpa. Grandpa's buried in the cemetery about 10 miles, maybe a little more, off the reservation. And the cemetery is not officially a Mohican cemetery, but everyone buried in there is a Mohican. And we had already been out in the car for an hour, and I'm just listening to story after story. And we go to the cemetery to visit Grandpa, her husband of 53 years. And we're walking the cemetery, and we walk the cemetery for another hour and a half because she knows every person in the cemetery. And she will tell you why this brother is buried completely across the cemetery from that brother, because they never got along. And why this person has to be buried here, because when they dug this grave, they found someone who wasn't supposed to be there, buried there. And guess who they called when they said, who is this? They called my grandmother, because she knew who it was. Story after story. An hour and a half we spent in that cemetery. And before we leave the cemetery, we are standing in front of the grave of my grandfather. And I back up a step or two to give her some time. She doesn't get out there very much anymore. And she nonchalantly says, there's where I went to school. And I turn around. And about a mile in the distance on the horizon, and it was late in the year, the crops had been harvested, so I could see. I look, and there is the empty shells of dormitory buildings and classroom buildings. And I knew my grandmother had gone to a Lutheran residential boarding school. I didn't know where it was. I didn't know anything about it. She's hesitant, always has been, to talk about her years there. She was there for 8 years. And she just mentions, there's where I went to school. She points over her shoulder like that. Didn't even turn around and look, just points. And I see it and I say, Grandma, when we leave here, can we go there? Yeah, I suppose. So I give her time to talk with Grandpa, and I put her back in the car, buckle her in, and we drive. It's just over a mile. It's not a great distance from where we were to her school. And we pull up and we park in the shadow of this school. And this woman, who for 2.5 hours her mouth could not stop telling stories, falls dead silent. Silent. And I got out of the car and I walked around, and Grandma let herself out of the car. She grabbed onto my arm, and we walked from one building to the next, and she might touch a brick on the building or find a stump of a tree and touch that. But for half an hour that we were on that campus, she never said a word. Because the story was alive in space and not dead in time. 8 decades had passed. Our Western mindset says that's 8 decades of distance that she is from that story. She should not fall silent. But story's alive in space, not dead in time. And it wasn't 8 decades for her. For 30 minutes, this woman, who for 2.5 hours could not stop talking, now could not utter one word. And I asked her, Grandma, are you ready to go? And she just nodded. And I put her in the car, and I buckled her up. And we drove away. And when her school was in my rearview mirror. Her mouth opened again. And she started telling stories. When we awaken to story, it invites us into celebration, into life, into renewal. But it also reminds us that we are people who experience great pain. And both can be present in the same space, which if you were on the tour, we experienced that yesterday. The beauty of creation and the trauma of domination, colonization. Genesis and genocide in the same 2.5 acres. Because the story's there. The ceremony returns. Will my grandma ever speak about her years in boarding school? I doubt it. I wish she would, but I'm not going to force that. But they took her voice. They took her voice. This is the understanding we have, Native peoples. We approach story differently. College students working on master's thesis projects in history and things have approached my grandmother and with frustration beg her to tell her story. And it's this Western approach to story, right? Like they have a right to her voice. I say, you have no right to this story. You have no cause to be upset that she won't tell you about this. This is her story. This is her voice. And if she chooses to share it, be blessed. But understand, if she chooses not to, it was never yours in the first place. So, I just want to kind of take the temperature of the room, what's stirring. Hopefully we can have a conversation. Or otherwise we sit for the next half hour or so in stunned silence.
So are children encouraged to tell stories just by listening to elders? So it becomes something that's valued for them to do.
Yeah, and there is in our Native cycle of existence, there is story time. As we move into winter, that's the time for stories, because there's not a lot else to do. Hopefully your food's put up, your supplies for the winter are there. Not a lot of hunting to be done in the winter. There's no harvesting or crops to do. And so it becomes this time, the time for stories. And that's when the grandmothers or the grandfathers really, really, their voice is really heard traditionally. The beauty is in an oral understanding, the story stays alive. Because it's never written down. When it's written down, it becomes static. It becomes complacent. It's locked. It's locked on the page. And if a storyteller then comes and tries to tell the story and it doesn't match word for word with what's on the page, then there's arguments about the validity of the stories. This is what happens with the first 12 chapters of Genesis, especially. Right? Because if you read early Genesis, and I know seminaries will tell you to read it as mythology. Don't read it as mythology, read it as story. When I read Genesis, I picture myself in a lodge, around a fire, and a storyteller, a grandfather, a grandmother. And guess what? Here's how this storyteller tells this story. And it's almost a shame that it was written down. Because now if another storyteller comes along and they tell it differently, wait a minute. When stories are oral, you expect the storyteller is going to craft the narrative in such a way that it fits the context. It fits the audience, it fits the context, it does those things. And it's not that you're playing fast and loose with the facts or the points of the story, but you're making it relevant. You're keeping it alive. It's alive. You're not the same person you were 10 years ago. You're not the same person you were yesterday because you're alive. So there's, if you were to tell the story of yourself today, it would be different than how you would tell the story of yourself last week. Because you've changed, because you're alive. Now, if you write your story, the story of yourself, that might become locked. And then people will argue with you about your own damn story.
Mm-hmm. And say which that, happens.
Yeah, which does happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, children are encouraged. I mean, because, you know, in this area, and I don't know about places, native cultures in other places, but I know in this area, the Plains, Woodland, Great Lakes area, winter was the time for stories. They'd go into the lodge because the days were short, the nights were long, and they're cold, and you have to keep yourself entertained, and stories are a great way to do that.
Be crossing the line in terms of like trying to take someone's story. So is asking to tell a story, is that already crossing the line, or is it up to someone else to come up with a story on their own? Would that be something that you think someone should have the ability to initiate or not?
I know that for some, if you as an outsider were to go to an elder and say, hey, tell me about this, or tell me about this, some would perceive that as very pushy. Some have this understanding that, hey, we live in kind of this dual world, and outsiders have this, outsiders are treating the storyteller with as much respect as they know how to do. So that is tricky. Certainly I would say never, ever, ever retell someone's story without their permission. Because that's a Western mindset that once the story is broadcast out there, it's public domain, and you wouldn't have wanted it shared if you didn't, I mean, you wouldn't have put it out there if you didn't want it shared. And that can be very tricky. So, when I started doing this work, these sacred sites tours and that, I had to go through a process of being vetted by Dakota elders. And there were three criteria that they were very, they wanted to make sure. Number one, that I knew the stories well enough to do them justice. Number two, that this was not a money-making adventure for me. I'm not charging people to hear these stories or enter these spaces. And number three, that my heart was good, that I was coming into these spaces in an appropriate manner. And it was only after I received sort of the go-ahead from several Dakota elders that I would even do this. If you want to...
Yeah, I agree with Jim there. We've always told stories. We have to wait till the first snow to tell stories. However, I've asked elders, and that's what you must do. And, you know, so we live and learn. You learn from that particular person, now is not the time. Or they open up and they do tell you this story. But you must ask, just like you must invite the spirit into you. We must ask. But a lot of times, natives will watch, look, and listen. And so if you're in a crowd of native people, watch, look, and listen, and follow the people, and you'll generally get a good understanding of what's to occur and how to do it. But anything in particular, sometimes if you ask for information, if there's other people around, they may be talking to somebody else but addressing that to you too. So this oral tradition is what's kept the people alive as well, because oral tradition promotes the fact that you'll come to an elder and say, "Uncle, when do I plant these seeds so my family can eat?" And he'll say, "Well, my girl, you must wait till this star's in this position. And then you must plant them in the dark of the moon and put a fish by this, and you put your beans and your corn and your squash together." Well, then you know. And he felt empowered because somebody who came to him and said, "Will you please tell me how to live?" And so then he values you as a young one that's looking for what he carries, that information, that knowledge, that way to live. So it promotes a healthy socioeconomic relationship that way of understanding. And so in our culture, kids always respected elders. And even now, even with the young people I work with, I worked for the Division of Indian Work for 10 years, and I had a Native father group, and I've gone into the prison and jails every other Sunday. That's what I did, is offer a pipe and a sweat lodge for inmates to help them understand that they're beautiful people, that they are a victim of circumstances, and that we need them and love them. So I go to them because we can. And you know, it's important that young people respect elders, because they're going to be old too. And so we're perpetuating that, how do we live? How do we get old? It's because this young man took the time to take his little grandma, put her in a car, and buckle her in, and drive her around. Because he loved her, he cared to listen to her stories, and he ingested that, and that makes him who he is. He's strong, not because he's a mountain of a man, but because he's got a little grandma right in her heart. And you see her every time he pulls her out and tells about her. You see that lady, that strength. And that's the beauty that you see, is by what he can reflect that way. So oral tradition promotes a healthier exchange in a community where young people respect elders. Elders can look at any child. I look at any child like my own. If the child's in danger, "Hey, sonny, don't walk over there. There's a car coming," you know. And I acknowledge their presence. So as elders, we try to empower young people and put them into position to stand up. And with the knowledge we give you, to carry that forward and to perpetuate that story of oral tradition. That it's not based out of ignorance and the inability to make black marks on paper. But we knew the intrinsic value of this oral tradition, in that my words are saying more to you than the English words your ears are hearing. If your ears and eyes are open of your heart, they look and see in a different way. The eyes of your heart don't see like these eyes. The ears of your heart don't hear like these ears. And so that's a new way of understanding. If you try to go to that place, this is so important, because this is the place we know as wisdom and truth. You don't have to think about it. You know it. You feel it. And you must trust that. Women have a more innate sense of an ability. That's why they say, trust your instinct. Women live down here in the center of your womb, where you give life. And you carry your weight down here. Men all live up here, you know, and we're up top heavy, and we're all up here. And some people are so smart, they can't let go of their intellect enough to understand. So from here, you gain understanding, truth, and knowledge. From here, you gain different understanding. So we're incorporating these in our being. And so the purposefulness of oral tradition, and typically natives used to use sign language. So not only were we using, sitting there talking like this without moving my eyes or any facial gesticulation, we use our whole body, which uses more of your cerebral cortex, and that we're more than our mind. Our heart has synaptic responses just like the cerebral cortex. Our stomach has the same thing. So there's a brain here, there's a brain here, there's a brain here, there's a brain here. And we're multidimensional beings operating in that way. That's how we know and understand. So oral tradition is huge, and it's great, and we should promote it more. Mm-hmm. That's why our language is so important. That's why we didn't write it down. Dakota and Lakota, I don't know about Mohican, or I know Anishinaabe and some Dene, is phonetically written language. You know, Father Harvey Buchel wrote a dictionary for Lakota language, but it's phonetic. So how it sounds is usually the way it's spelled. We have different glottal stops. We have different accents we put on our words. But that describes the people. Dakota and Lakota is like the people where we live. Harsh, sharp, and angular. Try and live out on the prairie, in the wind, in the snow, in the sun, in the heat. It's difficult. Anishinaabe, they come from the forest in the north. The water's bubbling and rolling and round, and their language is more round and bubbling like that water. Lakota and Dakota, our language reflects how we lived. Mohican come from that place of the ocean and the mountains come together, and their language is similar to that. So our language, and I think the genetic engineers who tried to do the genocide knew that. It was the strength of who we are. I don't know my language. I've gained what I know a word at a time. And the only Dakota or Lakota I speak is a bastardization, gained a word at a time in crafting my prayers. So our language is a spoken prayer. And so when you speak our language, you're incorporating all those understandings, all rolled into one. And it's like praying. If you sit there silently, still, and pray, it's very effective. But you look at those nuns sitting in there, and they're working their beads, and they're using their hands. You look at some native person praying, and they're making prayer ties. They're using that sacred herb we use for the reasons we use tobacco. Tobacco is a sacred herb because it has the ability, when you hold it in your hand, the photograph, Carillion photography has validated spirit, you can see it. When we pray with tobacco, it has the ability to record that energy prayer. When we use different colors of cloth to make our prayer ties, color is a frequency vibration, red being the longest, blue being the shortest, fastest. So spirits see that vibration. When they smell that tobacco, they love it. It vibrates real high frequency, ultraviolet, blue. So they're attracted to it. And then they're obliged to read that prayer that's encoded on there like a cassette tape, you know. So the earth spirits that come around and see, you know, we only validate that we can see with our five senses. Natives, we operate in many, many, many dimensions. Many dimensions. And we validate that existence in our prayers. We validate and acknowledge the existence that we are not the top of the food chain here. There's other life forms that exist multidimensionally at the same time. Some of our spirit helpers, people try to find a Sasquatch or, you know, try to find this one or that. They'll appear if you pray. They'll come in that way of understanding if you need to see that. It's kind of a need to know. So to explain to some people who have deaf ears and blind eyes, they'll never understand. That's why they say they have eyes, but they can't see. They have ears, but they can't hear. So to be reborn in this way of water, in this indigenous sun, we use our whole being, and we know that, and we acknowledge that. I get knowledge from the trees, from the wind, from the stars, from everything that crawls. Every grain of sand is just as important as a mountain of rock, because it was a mountain of rock. And every drop of water came from this universe, from the Creator. It flowed from the source. If that's what they validate discovery on, to find the source of the river, and if this is the river of life, this Holy Spirit comes on, then try and find the source. Go to the source. But maybe it's not as vast as you might think. Maybe it's smaller than you can even imagine. And we can't get our big minds around that little space. So sometimes think small. Think small, infinitesimally small. And you can vibrate with that frequency of the Creator. So oral tradition and indigenous understanding incorporates a lot more than we can linearly understand. You know, so if you accept that fact, that we are just a part of this mystery, that's why our word for God, Wakantanka, is what great mystery is this? And that's what we have.
This quick, something Bob said with Taekwag, as we're growing, we're listening and we're watching, and somewhere along the way, if we're smart enough, unlike me, you'll pick up how things ought to be done, as opposed to the original question, do you ask? No, and there's always ways to ask it. But I, personal example, for me, I thought I watched very well, and I thought I heard very well. And I was going on, I was in a naming ceremony, and I had to bring tobacco. And I brought the tobacco, and he said, do you have any tobacco? And I said, yeah. So I gave him the tobacco. We were kneeling in the middle of the floor. So I handed him the tobacco, and he threw it back at me. What the hell? He said, that's not how you hand someone tobacco. You open it up and you touch it, and then you give it to me. And I went, all right. Now, you may think that's cruel, but he taught me a lesson, because if you give me tobacco that way, I won't take it and throw it at you. I'll say, the proper way to do this is this. The other thing is, the oral tradition is so important to us that, you know, it's almost like a religion. It's those who are hooked on the written down, got to have a picture and all that other kind of stuff, get upset when we do things at college where I work. We do a lot of traditional things at the college. They want to film it, and we won't let them, and they get mad. We can speak. We can do all sorts of things, but we'll always do a pipe ceremony like we did this morning and say, now, you have to shut all your cameras off, and you can't take any pictures of this, and you can't do that. And, you know, after saying it, I mean, somebody's still, you can still hear the click. They still have to take the picture. They have to say, this is what I saw. Why can't you just go and explain what you saw? Mm-hmm. If you can't explain it, then you didn't get the picture. Yeah. That's all there is to it. It really is. So, you know, I made a mistake in that. I just say, I don't care. Just go ahead. I was doing something for down in Sleepy Eye, yeah, down there with a pipe, and they wanted to film everything in court. I said, "Well, I don't care. Does anybody here care?" And nobody said anything. And so that's cool. They had the cameras going, and I started to say something, and my partner with me came to me, and she said, "There's a problem," and I said, problem. You need to come over here and talk to these ladies. There's some elderly Sioux ladies from down there in Morton. And I said, what's the problem? We don't want that filmed. And I said, oh. I did, that's all they said. They didn't say anything else. I just said, I just learned something. Yeah, it may be okay with me, but it's not okay with the people that I was invited there to go and do something. And they were treating me very well, and I was just going to violate that without even thinking. And no, they wouldn't say anything, because it was a very small minority of these elderly Sioux ladies standing over here. And so they wouldn't say anything because nobody else said anything. And then I learned that lesson. We believe, I know a lot of people believe, that you learn more from the mistakes you make than anything I can sit here and say, do this, this, and this on the chalkboard or a PowerPoint. That you make the mistake and then you, this is where you went wrong and this is what you did. Hopefully nobody will have to throw the tobacco back at you. But I need to learn to never do that again. It takes a while.
Yeah, and it's very funny because you're going to make mistakes in this, and that's fine. One of the mistakes I see most often when Bob and I are talking is someone will ask us a question, and that's fine to ask a question, and I don't know if you've noticed, but our answers can be very long-winded, and so we'll be answering, and then they'll kind of like try to redirect the question, and we have to say, we're getting there. Because native storytelling, native oral tradition is circular. So you might ask a question and you're expecting this linear answer, but you're not going to get it. You're going to get this. And before your answer comes, you have to go on this journey, but your answer will come. And then also is this idea of listening properly. And one thing I've noticed is white people hate silence. They're so uncomfortable with silence. And they even do this thing where they just, if there's a brief silence, they have to make a noise just to interrupt the silence. And there was a friend of mine, he's a white gentleman, and found himself 2 years ago in this horse ride ceremony with Dakota and Lakota people. And he's sitting at a table. He was one of three white people on this journey, and all the rest are Dakota and Lakota people. And he's just sitting at this table, and he's listening to a conversation between two or three native people take place. And he's listening to this conversation, and he's doing exactly what white people do because they're uncomfortable with silence. Making noise in the silence, right? And every time he made a noise, the conversation stopped, and everyone at the table would look at him because they assumed he had something to say. Like he's making noise because he wants to speak, and he doesn't want to speak. He just didn't want the silence. And so just, there's these little things. Part of it is understanding how to listen. How to sit in silence. As Brian said, to watch. Learn by watching. Learn by listening. And then doing your best. And then learn by your corrections that you get.
The funny thing is, when we're smudging, you go up there and you smudge, just do it like that. But then you take down the next person who's never done it before and they don't know what to do. They just did it. All you got to do is follow what they did. Mm-hmm. They didn't drop dead by doing it.
Yeah.
To see that every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, I'm getting hungry.
Eat well today, huh?
So, huh?